the sixth grade. I was 12 years old, and our family was taking our first real spring break. I mean, we weren't just going to South Dakota to see my grandma. We were going to Orlando. It would be the first time I would get on an airplane. We would swim in a pool and see the sun and go to the beach and go to the Kennedy Space Center because that's what my dad wanted to do. But on our itinerary was also Disney World. And we spent magical days riding rides and seeing the wonders, and it was awesome. It was awesome until we entered the Hall of Presidents. And that's when Disney World lost its magic for me. It was so boring. I mean, here we were in this room full of wax figures of dead men whose names I didn't even know, nor did I really care to know. So I moped around, looking down and shuffling my feet. And finally, I saw my dad's feet, and I went up and I took his hand, and I was getting ready to start whining. This is so boring. I want to go on Space Mountain again. When can we leave? And then I looked up and realized it wasn't my dad. I had grabbed a stranger's hand. Think about it, a middle school girl holding hands with a man she didn't know, and I was mortified, so embarrassed. I could have been done for the day. I could have left Disney World altogether and gone back to the Super 8. And because I had been looking down, I grabbed the wrong hand, and I have learned that it is really important to look up. Think about it in the seasons that we encounter and in nature. If you only look down, you will miss the beauty of all the things that God has made. One of my elders was in the habit of walking quite a bit, and she told me that she spent a lot of time looking at the ground because she was afraid of falling down, tripping on the bumpy, uneven St. Paul sidewalks, or stumbling or getting hurt. And one day I said to her, "When you were walking, did you see that crabapple tree with all of those glorious pink blossoms?" And she said, "Nope. When I'm walking, I'm only looking at the ground." And she said, "Sometimes I have to remind myself to stop and look up, or I know that I miss so much." In 2020, when we—I forgot this part. Hi, everyone. I'm looking down at my notes, and I still can't get it right. Okay, I've been thinking a lot about what it means to keep looking down, and we spend a lot of time looking down. Put your hands like this. What is something that you are looking down at a lot? Maybe if I put my thumbs here, you'll know what I mean. For those of us that do that, we spend time looking down at our phones and our iPads and our Chromebooks and our laptops on whatever things you play your games with, and we miss out a lot from just looking down. What I meant to say was in 2020, when I started to have to work at home a lot, I made this little spot by our front window, and I put a comfy chair there, and I would sit there hour after hour with my computer on my lap trying to figure out what I was supposed to be doing. Staring at my screen, and every now and then I'd see a little movement out of the corner of my eye, and I'd look up and I would see a bird at the bird feeder. But one day I saw some movement and I looked up, and in my front yard were three deer. And that never happens. All three of them standing in the yard looking in the window at me while I looked out at them. And I know that if I had not looked up at that moment, I would have missed it. If you keep looking down, you miss out on so much. And looking up allows you to see what's happening all around, in literal and spiritual terms. We're doing this call to worship for this series called Look. Week after week, we speak these words from Psalm 121. The writer says, "I look up to the mountains. Where does my help come from?" The writer of the psalm is going about life, knowing that he needs help and knowing that he just can't go about things alone. So he says, "I look up to the mountains." And in the ancient Near East, that's where most people would look for their help. That was the place where people would build altars and shrines and memorials. That was the place they would go to say, "This is where our God might be. Let us look to this place for help." They had all kinds of different gods to honor and all kinds of ways to honor them. They believed they needed to try to make these gods, remember lowercase g, happy, and they wanted to avoid trouble, so they would look up to the mountains where they had built these altars for help. The writer of this psalm says he looks up to the mountains, but he doesn't find his help there. He needs to look up higher. He he says, "My help comes from the Lord, the maker of heaven and earth." The psalm writer says the only place to look for help is to look up to God for help. And I mean God with an uppercase G. God is in Yahweh. And we read this psalm and we're invited to ask the same question: where does my help come from? And then we're invited to answer in the same way: my help comes from the Lord. We were never meant to face life on our own. We have this God who created us and who made us for relationship with him. This perfect parent who is ready to help and at work all around us. But if we're often looking down, for whatever reasons, we might miss out. I think there's a number of reasons that we miss what God is doing and things that we spend our time looking down at. But today I want to think about two of those. I think one of the things that causes us to look down instead of up is what I would call darkness. Think about when you walk in the dark. If you're outside at night, you look down at your feet because you're looking to see if there's something that might cause you to stumble. And in the same way, when we walk through a dark time in life, a time that's difficult or painful or confusing, it's easy to turn your gaze down and it's hard to look up and see what God is doing. Darlene Dibler was a young woman in the early 1940s, and she had recently gotten married. And she and her husband sensed that God was calling them to the mission field, and they looked up and followed God's call to Southeast Asia. And they settled into this place, and they began telling people all about Jesus, and then World War II broke out. Darlene Dibler was captured by Japanese soldiers, separated from her husband and friends, and accused of being a spy. And she was put in prison, and she entered a season of darkness. As she sat in this prison alone day after day, she became very ill. She had dysentery. She had malaria. She had no news from her husband or her friends and no idea when she would ever be free again. She would sit there alone in her cell with nothing to read or nothing to do. And her way to try to look up was to lay on her cot and try to remember the Bible verses that she had learned as a child. She longed for fresh air. And then one day realized there was a small window up in the corner of her cell, and she figured out if she could stand with her foot on the doorknob and part of the bed frame that she could grab the bars on that window and pull herself up enough just to grab a breath of fresh air. And so she did that, and just for a minute she could do that, and she ran out of strength and she sat back down again. It took all her strength just to try to grab a breath of fresh air. Week after week went by, and she was kept in her cell, except for when she was taken to be interrogated. And one day, when she was lying on her cot, she heard voices. And she realized she could hear the voices coming through that window in her cell, so she climbed up again to look down. She held on to all the bars, and she looked down, and she realized she could see outside, and there was a courtyard down below, and there were people in the courtyard. There were soldiers and a few of the women who were prisoners walking around in this courtyard. And she thought, they get to go outside. They get to be out there while I'm stuck here. And she noticed one woman in particular who was walking the perimeter of this little courtyard close to the bushes that closed it all in. And this woman kept looking over her shoulder to see if the guards were looking at her. So she caught Darlene Dibler's attention. This was her only entertainment, to watch and see what would happen. And finally, when the guard turned to look away, this woman reached her hand into the shrubs and pulled it back and stuffed something into her dress. And Darlene was able to see just for a second that it was a bunch of bananas. Someone on the outside was providing for this prisoner, and no one saw her except for Darlene from up above. Out of energy, she dropped back to the floor, and she says in her memoir, all she could think about was bananas. How they would smell and how they would taste and how they would do so much for her body. And she prayed, Lord, just one banana. And then she said she immediately began to second guess herself. How could God do that? She didn't know anyone on the outside that might bring something for her. And she wasn't even allowed to go outside. A banana was impossible. And she looked down into the darkness again. Sometimes army officers would come to the prison for inspections. And when an officer came to her cell, Darlene was supposed to stand up and then bow down. And if she didn't do it right, she would be struck. So one day she heard footsteps approaching, and before she could get to the ground, the door opened and two men walked in, and she looked up into a face of someone she recognized. She said, "Mr. Yamaji, it's just like seeing an old friend." This man had been the first director of the first prison camp that she had been taken to. And he looked at her and he asked her if she was ill, and she said yes. And he asked her if she had any messages for friends at another camp, and she said, "Tell them I'm all right and that I'm trying to trust the Lord." And he left the door, or he left and closed the door. Suddenly she realized she had not bowed down, not to him or to the guard at the door, and she was sure that they would come back after he was gone and beat her. So when she heard the footsteps returning, she climbed off of her cot, terrified, and bowed down with her face to the floor. She heard the door open, and then the guard came in and said something strange. He just said, "They're yours, from Mr. Yamaji." She heard a strange sound, and the guard left, and when she looked up, there in front of her on the floor was a pile of bananas. She counted them. There were 92 bananas at her feet. And she writes that she sat and wept. She said she had spent so much time looking down into the darkness of the situation, looking down at what others had that she did not, that even when she prayed, she didn't look up and believe that God could answer her. She hadn't even believed that God could provide just one banana, and now there were almost 100 just for her. She looked up to see and to say, "My help comes from the Lord." In the dark, it is so hard to look up. When you live with pain or grief or uncertainty, it's easy to keep on looking down. But there is only one source of help. There's only one for us, so we need to look up and to say, "Where are you, God? How will you show up in this situation?" Not likely with 92 bananas, but more likely that God shows up with just enough help to get through the day. When it's dark, it's easy to keep looking down. And literally, on these dark, cloudy days, it's hard. I don't know when the sun is coming out again, and it's hard. And I know for some of you, this fog is hard, it's just hard in all ways, on your heart and your mind and your body. And so I invite you to look up to God and look up and ask for help. If you're someone that needs that little extra help from your doctor or a therapist or something, look up, because these days are hard in the dark, and darkness can cause us to look down instead of up. The second thing I think that causes us to look down instead of up is shame. Shame in our lives causes us to hang our heads. Sometimes we hang our heads because of something that we've done, something that you've done that you don't want anyone else to know about, a secret that you hold because you're embarrassed or ashamed. Or you think, "If anyone knew what I had done or I had said, if anyone knew what I thought, they would want to be far from me." Sometimes shame is about something that we've done, and sometimes shame is about what someone else has done to us. Maybe someone hurt you and told you to keep it quiet, or said it was your fault, or you deserve that. Maybe someone or someones have said something about you or to you, about how you just aren't enough. You're too slow, too fat, too ugly, too bad, too weird, not as good as, fill in the blank. And all of those things make you feel like you're not good enough and not lovable and not worthy of looking up, and you hang your head. Here's another story. It has Jesus in it. Jesus was going about doing Jesus stuff, going to different places and healing people and including people that nobody liked and teaching new and radical things. And along the way, Jesus made some enemies, and they were always out trying to trick him. So in John 8, here's what happens. Jesus went to the Mount of Olives. At dawn, he appeared again in the temple courts where all the people gathered around him, and he sat down to teach them. The teachers of the law and the Pharisees brought in a woman caught in adultery, and they made her stand in front of the group. "So these men have come and they grabbed this woman who's in big trouble. Adultery is one of the big 10 in the 10 commandments, and they've caught her in this sin. God had said no, and the punishment was stoning, so they drag her in front of Jesus, in front of all of these people, and now there are people standing around that are ready to throw stones at her." throw stones at the accused until she would die. So she stands there in front of a whole group of people who now hate her. They know her secrets. They know what she has done, which she wouldn't have wanted anyone to know. And they think they're better. They're picking up their stones, calling out names, ready to punish her. And I guarantee that she was looking down, hanging her head in shame, fearful for her life, not wanting to look anyone in the eye. And so these men say to Jesus, "Teacher, this woman was caught in the act of adultery. In the law, Moses commanded us to stone such women. Now, what do you say?" And John says, they were using this question as a trap in order to have a basis for accusing him. But Jesus bent down and started to write on the ground with his finger. They asked this question of Jesus, "What are you going to do?" And they think they've got him. They think that they've tricked him. We've got Jesus between a rock and a hard place. You see, if he says, "Do not stone her," then he's not following the Jewish law. But if he says, "Go ahead and stone her," he is breaking the Roman law and he's authorizing the killing of a woman. And now everybody is watching and listening. What's he going to do? What do you think Jesus will say? What do you think is going to happen here? So what does Jesus do? He gets down on the dirt and he starts writing. Jesus plays in the sand, and now everyone is really curious. What's he doing up there? Can you see him? What's he writing? Why is he doing that? And the men that have brought her are impatient with their questions. Verse 7, when they kept questioning him, he straightened up and said to them, "Let any one of you who is without sin be the first one to throw a stone at her." And again he stooped down and wrote on the ground. One simple sentence is his answer to their question. If you've never sinned, if you don't have anything that you want to hide, if you're proud of everything you've ever done or said, if you can look up with no shame, go ahead and judge her. Go ahead and throw that stone. And then he goes back to the dirt. Verse 9, at this, those who heard began to go away, one at a time, the older ones first, until only Jesus was left with the woman still standing there. And Jesus straightened up and asked her, "Woman, where are they? Has no one condemned you?" "No one, sir," she said. "Then neither do I condemn you," Jesus declared. "Go now and leave your life of sin." So here's this woman, and I really wish I knew her name, because she had one. But here's this woman who has been front and center all this time, who stood there with her head hung down in shame, able to hear what was happening. But looking down, she's had a front row seat to whatever it was that Jesus wrote on the ground. Don't you want to know what it was? Whatever it was, she saw. But look at what Jesus had done. Jesus placed himself at her feet. He put himself on the ground so that he was lower than she was, so that no matter what, she was looking at him. And then as he stands, she has to look up. She has to look up to see his face as he looks into her eyes to speak to her. She sees where her help comes from. She has to look up to see that Jesus is offering her a new life and she can start all over again. She gets to look up and see that judgment has fled and that Jesus has sent her accusers away, that the lies that they've told about her, that the hate that they had for her is gone and her shame has been banished. And if she knew the psalm that we read, maybe she did, she would have said, "I look up to the mountains. Where does my help come from? Oh, I look farther. My help comes from the Lord, the maker of heaven and earth. My help comes from this Jesus who put himself at my feet and stood so that I could lift my head and see him. I look up beyond the hills. I look up and see Jesus who banishes sin and the shame that goes with it, who sends those away who would say otherwise. I look up and see Jesus who invites me to live with my head up, looking to him for everything." We're just a few weeks from the beginning of the season of Lent. And Lent is the 6 weeks that culminates in Easter. And leading up to that great day, we remember back the sacrifice that Jesus made for us. He died. He died the death of a criminal, and in his death he takes away all the sin and the mess and the shame of the world. He dies the death of a criminal, and in that time and place, that kind of death was a crucifixion. You know this, Jesus died on a cross. But that was no accident. It was part of the plan from the beginning. You see, a cross is lifted up. The dying person is raised above the eye level of the people that are standing around. Jesus had said to his disciples that if he was lifted up, he would draw all people to him. That's why Corey read that weird passage from Numbers. Maybe you're going, why are we reading this about venomous snakes? But Jesus refers back to that passage. He says, as Moses lifted up the serpent in the wilderness and the people looked up and were healed, he says, "And when I am lifted up, I will draw all people to me. I will bring healing and hope." And so as people stood around that cross, they had to look up and to see Jesus. The cross itself means that sinful humans with our heads bowed and shamed can look up and see Jesus. We can see that he loved us enough to suffer, to save us, and we can hear him as he asks God to forgive us. Here are these two stories, and there are story upon story that would tell us the same thing. They would call us to know where to look for our help. To know that when it is dark and we're troubled and anxious, confused and fearful, we look up to find God there to help. We find that when we are heavy with shame and looking down, we are invited to look up and to find forgiveness and freedom and life forever. I hope today is a reminder to you, a reminder to say, I know this, but I need to keep being reminded. I need to remember to lift my head and to lift it as high as I can to the God who is my help. And if it's new news to you today, then thanks be to God. You are invited to look up and ask God for that help and that hope, that healing and forgiveness. Would you join me in prayer? I lift up my eyes to the hills. Where does my help come from? My help comes from the Lord. Today, you have probably bowed your head and closed your eyes because that's how we've been taught to pray. But imagine today that Jesus is before you, and right now all you see are his feet because your head is bowed. But Jesus reaches out a hand, puts one finger gently under your chin, and raises your head to look up, to look into his eyes. What does Jesus say to you? Perhaps he says, I know it's dark, but I'm here. Let me be your light. Maybe he says, I know you feel ashamed, but that has no place here. Look into my eyes and see what I see. You are my beloved. You are forgiven. You are a new creation. And as you look into the eyes of Jesus, what do you say to him? Lord, in your mercy, hear our prayers. Lift our heavy hearts. Lift our heavy heads, those that are bowed low in darkness, and let us look to you and see your light. Lift our heads out of shame, Lord, and look to you to see hope and forgiveness and new life. Help us look beyond the hills and to see you, for you are our help. Thank you, Lord Jesus. Amen.